Acquaintance with Grief. They came the seventh day after Jacob had received the sign, they too with sackcloth round their loins, and their hair full of ashes. They were sick at heart, and none of them understood how they could ever have persuaded themselves that all would be well, and the father's heart would return again to them, if only the spoiled brat were out of the way. Long ago they had discarded the hope, and wondered that they could ever have entertained it. On their journey thither, they confessed haltingly to each other and to themselves that putting Joseph away had in no wise altered their father's attitude to them. They were pretty well aware how Jacob was taking it, and how he felt about them. They understood in what uneasy discomfort their lives would henceforth be led. Deep within the father, obscurely, and perhaps not quite consciously, he thought of them as the murderers of the boy. Perhaps he did not believe that they had slain their brother with their own hands. Somehow the beast had done it for them, taking away the blood deed and doing according to their wish, so that in his eyes they might be guiltless and unassailable, and yet the more despicable murderers. In reality, of course, it was just the other way round. They were guilty indeed, but were no murderers. However, they could not tell the father that. To clear themselves of the blood guilt, they must have confessed their guilt, which would have meant forswearing their oath and their bond. Though indeed they had moments when they found the oath as futile as everything else. In short, no comfort could be expected, none at all. They could see that perfectly well. A bad conscience is bad enough, but a bad conscience with a grievance is almost worse, for it makes sullen confusion in the soul. It is both foolish and anguishing, and cuts a sorry figure. Thus, then, they would stand before Jacob all their life long, the ten, and there would be no relief. For he suspected them, and they learned to know what that means, a mistrust and suspicion. One man mistrusting himself, in that he mistrusts another, and the other in himself. So others cannot have the repose he cannot find himself, but must peer and pry and taunt and plague himself by plaguing others. For that is the nature of suspicion and incurable mistrust. All this they perceived in the first moment when they stood before Jacob. They read it all in the look which he directed toward them, as he raised himself a little from the arm on which he lay. That gaze, reddened by weeping, melancholy and piercing at once, anxious and mistrustful, tried to penetrate their hearts, yet knowing it could not. It held them long before fitting words came. The unanswerable, already answered, empty, senseless, fruitless, pathetic query, "Where is Joseph?" They stood with hanging heads before that impossible question. Those sorry figures, those sinners with a grievance. They saw that he would spare them nothing, but make all things as hard as he could. When he knew of their approach, he might have risen to receive them. But, though a week had passed since he had received the sign, he lay there with his face on his arm, and only raised it after a good space of time. And his look conveyed the question which, in the abandonment of his grief, he insisted on asking them. He deliberately made use of affliction in order to lie thus before them and ask his question, so that it might sound like an outburst of anguish. They saw through all that. Men saw through each other in that distant day as well as in this. They answered wryly. Jehuda spoke for the rest. "We know, dear Lord, what pain and deep mourning hath afflicted thee." "Me?" he asked. "Not you also?" "Us too, of course," they replied. "Of us we would wish not to speak."
"Why not?"
"Out of reverence." A lamentable exchange of words. They shuddered to think that it would be so from now on.
"Joseph is no more here," he said.
"Alas," they responded.
"I gave him up to the journey," he said again, "and he exulted in it. I told him to go to Shechem, that he might bow before you and incline your hearts to return. Did he do so?"
"Alas, the tragic thing befell," they replied, "that he did not get so far as to reach us. Before he could do so, the wild beast had struck him down, for we were pasturing no longer in the Vale of Shechem, but in the Valley of Dothan. So the boy went astray and was struck down. We saw him no more with our eyes since the day when he announced to you and us in the field what he had dreamed.
The dreams, said Jacob, which he dreamed, they were then a vexation to you, heavy and great, so that you bore a grudge to him in your hearts?
Something of a grudge, they answered. A grudge indeed, yet in measure. We saw that his dreams gave thee vexation, for that you chid him, and indeed even threatened to pull his hair. Therefore we too were angry with him, to some extent. Now, alas, hath the cruel beast worried him far more than was thy intent.
It hath rent him, said Jacob, and wept. Why say you worried? For it rent and devoured him. To say worried instead of rent, it is a scorn and a mocking, and sounds like gladness.
Out of bitter affliction, they answered, it might happen that one said worried for torn, or even to spare the afflicted.
That is true, he said. You are right in what you say, and I must be content. But if Joseph could not incline your hearts, why then are ye returned? To mourn with you?
Then mourn, responded Jacob.
And they sat down with him to join in a lament, How long liest thou there? And as they did so, Jehudah supported his father's head on his knee and dried his tears. But after a little while, Jacob interrupted the lamentations and said,
I do not care to have thee support my head, Judah, and dry my tears. The twins shall do it.
The offended Judah gave over his father's head to the twins, and they held it a while as they lamented, until Jacob said again,
I know not why, but it is unpleasant to me that Simeon and Levi should do me this service. Reuben shall do it.
Hugely insulted, the twins gave over the head to Reuben, who held it in his turn, until Jacob said once more,
It suiteth and comforteth me not that Reuben holdeth my head and drieth my brow. Dan shall do it.
But things went no better with Dan. He had to pass on the head to Naphtali, of whom Jacob tired even more quickly, and chose Gad for the next in turn. Thus it went on through Asher and Issachar to Zebulun, Jacob saying each time something to the same effect,
I feel it vaguely displeasing that he should hold my head. Another shall do it.
Until all of them had been affronted and put aside. Then he said,
We will cease to mourn.
So they just sat silent round him with dropped jaws. For they understood that he partly thought of them as Joseph's murderers, which indeed they partly were, and if not wholly, then it was only by chance. They were mightily aggrieved that he took the part for the whole, and hardened their hearts. Thus, they thought, would their lives be spent from now on, sinners suffering under a misunderstanding which they could never wholly explain. This was what they got for putting Joseph away. Jacob's eyes rested upon them, those bright, brown, tear-inflamed eyes with the enlarged glands beneath them, those troubled eyes that were wont to be turned inward in musings upon the nature of God. Now they were bent upon his sons, always upon them whenever they themselves were not looking, brooding and spying in incurable misgiving and turning aside when one met their gaze. As they were eating, he began,
But if a man hath hired an ox or an ass, and there cometh a stroke, or a god striketh the beast so that it is dead, then shall the man swear and purge himself from guilt before he can be free from suspicion.
Their hands felt cold, for they understood what Jacob's words pointed at. Swear, they grumbled, their hearts sinking.
He must swear when nobody seeth how it went with the beast, and there is no blood and no wounding, such as the lion doth, or any beast of prey. But if there be blood or traces, who shall molest the hireling? It is the affair of the owner.
Is so the way of it?
So it standeth written?
But it standeth written
If a shepherd pasture the owner's sheep, and a lion killeth among the fold, then the shepherd shall swear an oath to clear himself, and the damage shall be the owner's. Then how standeth it with me? Shall not the hired shepherd also swear, if it seem clear and certain that the lion hath killed? Yes and no, they answered, and their feet too were cold by now. More no than yes, if it please thee. For if it is a sheepfold on which the lion falleth, then he draggeth his prey out away, and no one seeth, and it must be sworn. But if the shepherd can produce the slain, and bring forth some mangled remnant, then shall he not be made to swear?
You might all be judges, so well you know the law. But if the sheep were the judges, and were of value to him, but to the shepherd of none, is it not enough that it was not his, and of no worth to him, to force him to swear?
Not ever yet in the world was that enough to force an oath.
But if the shepherd hated the sheep, he asked, and looked at them with wild and frightened eyes.
Wildly, fearfully, with heart sinking, they countered the gaze. It eased their pain that his eyes roved from one to the other, so that none of them had to bear that mistrustful look for long at a time.
Can one hate a sheep? They asked,
and their faces were cold and sweaty.
That does not happen in the world. There can be no law concerning it, and it cometh not into consideration. But we are no hired shepherds, rather the sons of the King of Shepherds, and if we lose a sheep, so is it our loss as well as his. And all in all, there can be no talk of judging or of a compulsory oath in any case.
Such idle, cowardly, wretched talk. Must it go on like that for always? Then were it better that the brethren should go away again, to Shechem, Dothan, or elsewhere, since it was proven that their stay here without Joseph was as impossible as it had been with him. But did they go? Not at all. They stopped, and if one of them went his own ways, he soon came back. Their evil consciences had need of his suspicion of their evil consciences. They were bound to one another in God and in Joseph. In the beginning they suffered greatly in living together, yet they accepted it as penance, Jacob and his sons. For these knew what they had done, and if they knew they were guilty, Jacob knew that he was too. But time passed, and habit was reformed. Habit wiped the peering mistrust out of Jacob's eyes. Habit made vague in the minds of the 10 brothers what they had actually done. Gradually they lost sight of the distinction between doing and happening. It had happened that Joseph was lost. The question how slowly retreated behind the fact as father and sons adjusted themselves to it. He was not here. That was the fixed fact upon which they all came to rest. The 10 knew that he had not been murdered, as Jacob thought. But even this difference in knowledge lost meaning in the end, for to them, as to him, Joseph was a shadow, wandering far outside any sphere of human knowledge in the land of no return. In this idea, father and sons were at one. The poor old man, from whom God had snatched his treasure of feeling, so that no sweet spring could bloom any more in his heart, but only parching summer and the barrenness of winter reigned therein, and he was really as stiff as at the beginning in his seizure, did not cease to bewail his lamb, and when he wept, they did so with him, for their hatred was taken from them, until in the end they could not clearly remember how it was the fool had so angered them. They could even mourn him too, for they knew him to be safe in the shadow, and in absence, and buried outside the circle of their life. And Jacob did so too. He relinquished the idea of going down as mother and fetching Joseph back. He no longer distressed anyone with wild plans of begetting him anew, or shaping him out of clay and playing the part of God. Life and love are beautiful, but death has also its good side, hiding and preserving the beloved in past and in absence,
so that where once there were care and fear, there is now perfect calm. Where was Joseph? In Abraham's bosom, with God, who had taken him to himself, or whatever other words one finds for that last absence, all of them chosen to express gently and finally, if somewhat hollowly and bleakly, the ultimate security of all. Death, after having restored, preserves. What had Jacob done to restore Joseph since he had been dismembered? Death itself had seen to that, and quickly. Death had recomposed a whole out of 14 pieces, or even more, recomposed it in laughing beauty, and thus preserved him more sweetly and better than the people of the evil land of Egypt preserved their dead with bandages and spices, inviolate, unchanged, unchangeable, that dear, vain, brilliant, wheedling youth of 17 who had sat on White Huldah and ridden away. Unchanged, unchangeable, needing no more carefulness, yet ever 17, however much the years might increase since he rode away, and the years of the living increase with him. So was Joseph for Jacob. And so how shall any say that death has not its good side, however chill and hollow it may be? Jacob adapted himself to it. He looked back with chagrin upon his bickering and arguing with God in the first flowering of his grief, and no longer found it reactionary, but splendid and worthy of reverence instead, that God had not crushed him out of hand, but rather, in silent forbearance, had let him give rein to the intemperance of his misery. Ah, good old man, didst thou divine what amazing favor still lay behind the silence of thy dread and wonderful God, and with what incredible rapture thy soul was still to be shaken, according to his word? When thou wast young in the flesh, thou didst once awake at dawn to find thy dearest bliss turned to illusion and trickery. Very old must thou become before thou learnest that naught but illusion and trickery was thy sorest anguish likewise.